Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
GQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
Now, is that still the best doorman ever or what? Good evening and welcome once again to Madame Perry Salon. I am your host and your cruise director, Madame Perry, but also known as Jennifer Perry, or to my friends in England, Jennifer and Maudette Perry. And, you know, we've got so many cool things happening lately. It just gets better and better here. If you've been listening a lot lately and you haven't become a follower, please click the button here to be a follower if you're listening live tonight, or subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. That way I can continue to get sponsors and keep on having more cool people on. Like recently we had Kazim Sultan, a musician who at that time I think he was coming off a tour with Blue Oyster Cult, but also doing a solo tour of his own CD, his newest CD, his bootleg that he wants you to buy. But he's back out on the road with Todd Runger now, so definitely get Kazim Sultan's CD bootleg. And who else have we had? And Rudy Sarzo from Quiet Riot and Blizzard of Oz. It's just been wonderful. Michael Fleeman, true crime writer, was here. Also Matt Coyle, suspense crime author from San Diego. It's been a lot of fun. And coming up soon, we've got Athena Bass. She's a musician, but she was also on the TV show Rockstar Ex-Wives. It was a reality show. She's going to be here in a few weeks, as well as, let me see who else is coming up. Got a lot of good shows. In May, well, you know, we had Alison Arngrim, too, and that's a very popular show. It's got a lot of downloads. Alison Arngrim, you may remember as Little Nellie Olson from Little House on the Prairie. We talked about her book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, and it's a memoir. And who would have known that all those tantrums and things that Little Nellie Olson was throwing as the little bad kid on Little House on the Prairie was actually helping her work through a lot of her frustration and anger at being, at the time, she was being sexually abused by her older brother. But as is the case too often, people just weren't listening to her. And also coming up on the 3rd of May, Randy Ross with his brand new book that we've all been waiting for, God Bless Cambodia. You don't want to miss Randy Ross. And you definitely want to be here tonight, too, because as you probably already know, I am so excited about this guest. I read her book earlier this year, and I just couldn't wait for it to be out and to get her on the show. It's quite a coup. She's a Sunday Times top 3 best-selling author. She's written nearly a dozen books. Probably by the time I finish saying this, she'll have a few more. But she's written, you know, humor, bio, history, children's books, all kinds of stuff. But tonight's a different book, and it's a story. It's a true story. It happened in America just about a century ago, in the roaring 20s, and it's called The Radium Girls. Then please welcome here into Madame Perry's Salon the fabulous Kate Moore. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you so much.
I am so delighted to have you here. I am doing wonderfully. Are you comfortable here in Madame Perry's Salon? I thought I told you it was a genie's bottle studio, so just kind of got a nice cushion.
Yeah.
Oh, good. So you've been on quite the route with Radium Girls. I mean, it's NPR you were on last week, and that's a pretty...
I know, on Saturday, yeah, the weekend edition show, just phenomenal. It's just so rewarding and amazing the way people are taking these girls to their hearts. I couldn't have asked for more, and I hope your listeners too are going to be intrigued by their story and want to celebrate them in the way that I have.
Oh, you know, I think so. And I think, though, and I find it unusual, you know, even though it's an American story and a true story, so many people here didn't know it. I didn't know about it until about 8 years ago when I read a book called The Poisoner's Handbook by Deborah Blum. Mm-hmm. And she mentioned them in there, and that was the first I'd heard of them. And so it takes a fine author like you from across the pond to teach us about our own history.
Well, you know, sometimes an outsider can shine a different light, can't they, in some ways. But, I mean, actually, the story has been told before by American authors, but they haven't chosen to focus on the women. So there are great books about the legal changes that the girls brought about, you know, quite academic books on kind of occupational health legislation and things like that, because the girls were iconic. But what my book does is to focus on the women. So it's written like a novel, and the girls are our heroines that we fall in love with, hopefully. And so it takes you through their journey, drawing on their own words, and hopefully brings them to life in a way that's not been done before.
Yes, and I think you did, you know, because you brought so many of them. You drew the picture for us. You know, we could just picture these girls. And especially there's so many period TV shows on now, so you can see what they look like, what they dress like, you know. Because we see them on Masterpiece Theater, so we knew how people dressed then, and we could just picture them just being happy, and they had jobs. And it was a well-paying job for a woman, and they were, you know, making money and having a good time. But let's start.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were living the good life. And so, but to start with, the Radium Girls, as we said, was a true story. And to start back for people who weren't really aware of them over here, just exactly who were they? Just collectively first.
Yeah, so the Radium Girls are the American women during the First World War and into the Roaring Twenties as well, who used to paint watches, clocks, and military dials with luminous radium paint. And they were taught to lips point, to put their paint brushes between their lips to make a fine point for the delicate handiwork. And in so doing, they were ingesting some of the paint. Now, they were told that the paint was safe, but the paint was not safe, and so over time they started to sicken. And their story and what the book charts is their incredible journey from, as you say, those amazing lucky girls who thought they were so blessed to have this job, which was very lucrative, and how they then cope when the radium poisons them, and how they fight for justice against the firms who deny all responsibility.
And radium at the time was just sort of like a new, exciting substance. It was a discovery by Marie Curie, am I correct?
That's right, yes. In 1898, radium was discovered. And, I mean, as you say, at the time the girls were working, when they first started working in the studios, another part of the appeal for the job, it wasn't just that they were paid very high wages for being dial painters. It was the fact they got to work with radium as well. So radium at that time was seen as this kind of elixir of youth that, you know, people kind of said in the adverts that it could make old men young. And it was sold as a health tonic. So you could buy radium water to try and, you know, prolong your life. That was mostly drunk by the wealthy and famous, because radium was very expensive at that time, which again added to the glamour. So it was actually more expensive than gold per gram. It was the most expensive substance
on Earth.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. It really was this kind of magical, mythical element that a whole lucrative industry sprung up around. So you could get radium cosmetics, you know, face creams and eyeshadows and lipsticks that would glow with this otherworldly light. And it would be in toothpaste, you know, guaranteeing a brighter smile with every brushing. And so at the time the girls were working, it was seen as this amazing, fabulous wonder element.
So, and you know, I think if you go, still go on YouTube now, they also, they have some, you can find some old, very old TV or radio commercials where someone is using a night cream or a cold cream with radium in it. And by the way, if you want to call in and talk to Kate Moore about the Radium Girls or ask her questions, you can call in at 646-716-9922, and Blog Talk Radio assures you that that is a toll-free call within the continental U.S. And actually, Kate, we already have a caller in here.
Ooh.
So I think it's one of our lovely regulars. Welcome to Madame Perry's Salon.
Hello, Kate. I'm Duffy.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm fine. This book looks absolutely wonderful. I can't
wait. I'm glad
wait.
You enjoyed it.
I noticed there's two different versions. Which one should we, or do you recommend that we get? And
They have slightly different.
I see them on Amazon. They have slightly different titles.
That's
one,
right.
I think, is a little longer.
Yes. So the UK edition was published last year in England, and that has a longer subtitle, which is they
I
paid
see.
With their lives, their final fight
uh-huh.
was for justice. And then the US version has only just come out, and that is the dark story of America's shining women. The American version, there are slight differences between them, but the American version has reading group questions. If you are a book group member, I would advise it for that. It's got more detail and background. There's an author's note in it that describes some of the research process of meeting the women's families and that sort of thing. And as any author would do, it's also got some corrections of things that I got wrong in the first edition that I could just tweak in the second edition. So I would recommend that you buy the American edition just because that's the most up-to-date. So, for example, since the UK version was published, I've managed to connect with one of the lawyers' families, Raymond Berry, and so they were able to give me a little bit more information than I was able to put in the UK edition.
Well, I see that they're both number one bestsellers. In fact, the Dark Story is a bestseller in labor and industrial relations, and a number one bestseller in toxicology.
Really? I didn't know that.
I think my husband pointed it out to me actually at the weekend, which was exciting.
Congratulations! It looks
Thank
like it's
so
doing
much.
quite
Thank
well. I want to. Is there a Audible version or?
Yes, there is. I think that might be on Amazon. I'm not quite sure, but yes, there is an audio book as well. So that is available. That is out there.
I forget who's reading it.
I think her name is Angela Brazil, I think.
Angela Brazil.
She was a fabulous actress. I had a choice of who could read it, and she had a wonderful voice, so I'm sure she's done a fantastic job.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I'm going to get all the versions, the Kindle and the hardback and the paperback and the Audible, too.
Well, I would encourage
and then we'll
that.
Get Audible for road trips,
I think the book kind of lends itself to an audiobook because of all the courtroom scenes, because it becomes like this courtroom drama. Where I've been able to use the real courtroom testimonies So it kind of works dramatically to have a voice reading it, because it's bringing to life these real conversations that actually happened.
I think it would make a great movie.
I hope so, especially
with all the authenticism of it. It's
I think it really
lends itself to that.
Yeah, I think the girls deserve it as well, because, you know, the book is getting us talking, which is fantastic, but movies have such a larger reach even than books do, that it would be wonderful if people across the world were going to see, I don't know, Jessica Chastain, or, you know, Jennifer Lawrence, or, you know, bringing them to life.
Uh-huh.
It would be wonderful.
Oh, yeah. It would be. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, if you want to call in, the number is 646-716-9922, and we are thrilled to be talking with Kate Moore, author of The Radium Girls, and, of course, one of Madame Perry Salon's favorite denizens. Duffy Odom is here with us and joining us. And also someone tonight, thanks to Kate's publisher, is going to win a copy. So that's very nice. I don't know who it is, but somebody's going to win a copy of The Radium Girls. Now, Kate, how did you first learn about The Radium Girls, or the story?
As the story, well, as you mentioned at the start, and as all your listeners will be able to hear, I'm not from America. I'm from the UK. And I discovered it originally, actually, because I discovered it through a play. And how I discovered that play was, I was looking for the next project I wanted to direct. And so I Googled great plays for women, because I wanted to, you know, I like giving actresses strong female parts that really allow them to shine. And this play, These Shining Lives by Melanie Marnich, came up on that Google search. And it sounded interesting, and I ordered it. And I knew from the moment I started reading the first page, I turned to my husband and I said, this is the one I'm going to do next. Because there was just something about story, and especially about the way Melanie had written it, which is a beautifully lyrical script. If anyone has a production of These Shining Lives near them, I would urge you to go and see it, because it's a beautiful play. And the story just really struck me. And so, because I wanted our production to be as authentic as it could be, I did lots of research. So I read the other books that are out there, and, you know, did as much research as I could to, you know, find out everything I could about the women. And I realized through that research process that there was no book that focused on the girls. There was no book that told their story from their perspective. As I say, it was all about the science or the legal changes that they brought about. No one was interested in who they were in terms of their dreams and their hopes and the families that they left behind when they got sick. And so I thought, this is a travesty. The women deserve their own book. You know, they deserve us not to forget who they were as individuals. They'd all kind of vanished behind this anonymous moniker of the Radium Girls. And so I thought, well, if no one else has done it, why don't I? And that's how it came about, basically. So I saw that no one had done it before, and I thought they deserve there to be a book that is about them, and, you know, enables people to get to know them and to appreciate their sacrifice and everything that they achieved in terms of workers' rights, because we've got a lot to thank them for.
Well, as an actor, I know that The scripts of plays are usually either with Samuel French, or they're with dramatist's play service. And These Shining Lives, you can get from dramatist's play service. You can get it online. It's just $9, and I'm sure it doesn't take anything away from the details and the authenticism of your book.
It's
a good companion piece. The acting version is like $9.
They're very different pieces, I think, the play and the and my nonfiction book. So and both of them, I think, work well in terms of bringing the girl's story to prominence. So that's all you can ask, really. There is another play as well called Radium Girls by D.W. Gregory, and that focuses on the orange women. So there are two plays out there about them.
The two separate groups. Oh, by the way, I have a message here from another friend of Madame Perry's Salon, David Hurley. Mm-hmm. And Kate, he's a poet and author, but he also has two online magazines. One is Subtlety, like the word subtle in the T-E-A, and the other is new in Bookalage, which is which has a lot of book reviews in it and features. And he just said he's really enjoying. He messaged in his comment here. He said he's really enjoying listening to you, learning about this. He would love to review the Radium Girls on Bookalage. And he said it's new, it's compelling. I'm fascinated by the fates of folks such as Marie Curie and Karen Silkwood, but I know very little about this book subject. And then he said, could a movie adaptation be in the future?
Well, we can but hope. That's all I will say. If there's any film producers out there that can see the potential, you know, let's make this happen.
Oh, yeah, let's do that. Okay, thank you, David. And so one of the things, though, that you did when, so I guess I should try to get back to where everything started was, so when the radium's a big thing, and it's the miracle thing, it's sort of, it would be today like it, back then, what it meant to people then, what people thought it was actually, would be today like a combination of, you know, some kind of quick collagen and Viagra and some kind of professional youth cream or everything that would just
they do actually think it could help with impotence, actually. So you're not at all wrong. They sold radium dock straps and lingerie to help with people's sex lives. So you hit the nail on the head.
So to speak, but it's so they had everything. So there are these companies. There's the companies that have they're having the dials painted on watches and I guess instruments on the dials of instruments for servicemen for the army for engineers and because and actually Duffy and David can both tell you, I have been pumping this book for the last couple, ever since you scheduled here on the beginning of every show. And I tell people about how the girls were told, it wasn't just their idea. They were told to take the brush, you know, when they went to brush the radium paint on the dials, to put in there and just kind of make a point of the brush on their tongue, with their lips, because dipping it, cleaning the brush or whatever would waste radium and would waste time, and they would, had to do a lot of output, and so that's what they were taught to do.
That's right. They think the technique came from China painting factories, because a lot of the first girls that were hired worked in China painting factories, and that was the technique that they had learned originally. So when the initial workforce was hired, they just kept, doing the same technique. And as you say, it was the only way to do it. Well, they were told it was the only way to do it because the companies wanted an efficient, way of applying the paint. And later, in the book, I talk about some of the different methods that they tried, but none of them were as effective as the brush. So they were taken away. You know, the girls didn't have their little dish of water anymore. They didn't have the rag. Lip pointing was resorted to as the better way, basically.
So they were true artists then.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was part of glamour. Yeah. One of the nice things in the research, actually, well, kind of nice in terms of you can see the appeal for the women, is that in the town directory for Ottawa in particular, but I'm sure it was the same in Orange as well, the women are listed in those town directories as artists. It says, you know, Margaret Looney, artist, the Radie and Dial Company. And so it really was this, as you say, artistic, glamorous career. It was well paid. They had this shine from the Radie in itself, which they'd get covered in. So they walk home through the streets and they would be glowing with the radium. It was just this luminous, alluring substance that the girls wanted to work with.
And they actually glowed in the dark.
Yeah.
They actually glowed in the dark. And that one of the most striking, horrifying things about the story is that, as I say, obviously radium, as you said, is luminous. So the girls got covered in it when they were working there. But the eerie thing about the story is that what happens to the girls is that because they've swallowed the radium, it ends up settling in their bones. And their families talked about how the girls themselves would start to glow. So because the radium was in their bones,
in their
bodies. And their, and the Catherine's nephew said you could see every bone in her body. That's what he said, because they were glowing.
All right, and I have another caller. Yeah, I have another caller in here. I think this is Kate to talk to you. And this is Kenya Colbert. She's a producer of a podcast or two, Everything Relationships, and also Through the Looking Glass, one for especially for children and families. But this is Kenya Colbert. Kenya, who is a disclaimer, also my BFF, is come on in and meet, and you see your pal Duffy, and meet Kate Moore.
Hello, guys. Hello, Kate. How are you today?
Hi, I'm so well. Thank you. Thank you so much for calling in.
Oh, I am enjoying the show, most definitely. I listen because I know that Madam Perry forever brings the best of the best in. But your story.
Am I the luckiest girl or what? The luckiest girl. But Kenya, did you know who the Radium Girls were before?
I did not. I mean, I have heard you talk about it this week, definitely sharing the story, and it is an unbelievable story, just crazy. But it really hit home to me because I'm thinking about all of the things that we don't know until it's too late. So I'm listening to the story, and I'm like, how many times in history have hindsight been that point where we're like, that really wasn't a good idea, but it's always somebody hiring someone else to do it and them not doing it themselves if it's such a great idea.
And the way that people that cause this don't take responsibility for it.
It's frightening.
Well, I mean, it's a similar thing, really, isn't it, with tobacco. If you think of that, you know, and what was interesting is when I was doing my research for the book, alongside the newspaper articles of the girls from, you know, this is from the 1920s and 1930s, were adverts saying, you know, a cigarette a day keeps the doctor away and things like that. So it's repeating itself. It's repeating itself through history.
How
that's sort of like
we just don't know until it's too late.
Yeah. Now, with the Radium Girls, though, so we're at the part of the story that they've got these jobs, and these are great jobs. They pay well. They're artists, and people, you know, think that's a great job to get. And these girls glow. And then sometimes that's kind of cool because maybe their clothes and their hair, or whatever, glow when they go out to dance or to go to a party or something. But then they all start developing problems. They start walking funny or start limping and start breaking bones. And take us through there at this point, Kate.
Yeah, so the thing about radium poisoning is it's really insidious. So it takes years to develop. So a lot of those bonny young dial painters who started in the First World War, by the time they started to get ill, they'd actually left the employment. So Grace Fryer, for example, had ended up working in a bank. Quinta Maggia had left and got married and had children. So a lot of the dial painters were kind of spread out. They were spread around. So to begin with, not everyone connected what was happening. And what was happening was the women would start by having an aching tooth. And the dentist, they go to the dentist, they say, my tooth is sore, and the dentist would pull it, extract it. And then the next tooth would start hurting, and it would be extracted. And then the next tooth, and then the next tooth. So a lot of the women lost most, if not all, of their teeth. What then happened was, after the teeth fell out, there were ulcers that sprung up. So if you can imagine how painful that would be to have your whole mouth as a mass of ulcers. And there was one girl, Molly Maggia, who they said her whole, basically the whole of her mouth and even some of the bones of her ears were said to be one large abscess. So this was really excruciating stuff.
Oh.
And the other thing that was insidious about it was that it didn't always start in the mouth for some girls. So for some girls, it would be an aching jawbone. For other girls, it would be an aching arm or a leg or a spine or a foot. So it was really hard to connect it all. But one thing was consistent, which they later realized, which was wherever the radium had chosen to settle, and as I say, it settled in different bones, the same thing was happening, which was that the radium was boring holes into their bones while the women were still alive.
Oh, my goodness.
So when they looked at the bones, they would say that they were honeycombed or moth-eaten. So if you can imagine what that must have felt like, it's just mind-boggling and horrific.
And these are young women, and most of them are single.
Yeah.
Some have just gotten married, started families.
Yeah. Most of the dial painters were teenagers when they began. So the book opens with Catherine Sharp's birthday, and she's 14, and that was an average age. So they're all teenagers, generally between 14 to 18 years old. So as you say, by the time they're getting sick, they're 19, 24 years old. A lot of them are getting married. They're trying to have babies. And for some, not all, but some women, they found that it was very difficult to get pregnant, or that they suffered stillbirths or miscarriages, or the children were born early. So this really was, you know, people kind of said it was almost like, you know, they were horrified by the fact that, you know, particularly at that time when a woman's worth in a way was often bound up in, you know, who she married and her family, the fact that it was robbing them of their fertility. And often, you know, as I say, with these teeth falling out and so on, robbing them of their look so that, you know, some of them did stay single forever. That was part of the devastation for them, that they'd started as these bright, bonny, beautiful teenage girls. And 5 years, 10 years on, you know, they've lost all their teeth, their jawbones are falling out of their mouths, they can't walk, they're crippled. Their bones, their legs have shortened because of the honeycombing in their bones. So some women, there was a 4-inch difference. So from having legs that completely measured up straight, one of them would shrink by 4 inches because of the radium. It was totally horrific, absolutely horrific stuff. And what I try to do in the book was to keep reminding people, you know, these girls are fighting for justice. They're going to court. They're trying to find a lawyer. They're trying to find a doctor in the first case who will listen. And they're doing it suffering from these, you know, incredibly painful, debilitating conditions. And yet they're still fighting on. I just think it's extraordinary.
Well, that's... And that's, see, to me, that is even more heinous, is that they're young, they're losing everything, you know, their health, they're in pain, they're just, nothing can help. They've got these astronomical medical bills, and they get to where they can't even pay them, they can't take care of themselves. Catherine, you were saying Catherine Shobe, she was a teenager, right? And
yep.
It says in here, there's a point where it says, and as for Catherine Shobe, nobody, and these are girls that had, you know, just lively, normal social lives. Said nobody even saw her. I'm reading from your book. Nobody even saw her anymore. She stayed at home and refused to go out. Quote, while other girls are going to dances and the theaters and courting and marrying for love, Catherine said mournfully, I have to remain here and watch painful death approach. I am so lonely. Mm-hmm. And so she basically only left the house to go to church, and that was it.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's right. Catherine's story is particularly sad, I think, because it is, you know, as you described in that incredibly powerful quote that she wrote, she was incredibly lonely, and this painful death approach, and that was the thing, you know, once it was discovered what was happening, all the girls that started getting sick, you know, the moment they had a sore tooth, they knew it had got them, you know, they were going to die. And so in Catherine's case, she actually, she had to go to a hospital for her nerves because, you know, she became suicidal and she couldn't cope. She was hospitalized for a short while. And so she had, you know, the dual thing. She had the physical debilitation, but also the mental debilitation that she had to cope with because she was still alive, but she knew what was going to happen to her. And that as well, I think, is an extraordinary thing. You know, they called them, you know, the living dead. Living dead because they knew what was going to happen, and they were in the process of dying. You know, every second that they lived was a second closer to death, basically.
Mhm.
Was there a danger that if they had any living children that they would also have symptoms themselves, or people around them that might have been intimate or just being around them? Was there a danger that they could be affected by it?
There are some interesting examples in the research archives. The scientists have never really done masses of work on it, so it's anecdotal. So it's just, you know, one or two stories that I can tell you about. But certainly there was an example in the archives which really made me sad, where the sister of a dial painter had died. And she had never been a dial painter, but she shared a bed with her sister. And her sister, who was a dial painter, had come home, as we said, covered in the glowing paint. And the two sisters would go to bed together. And so the second sister, who wasn't a dial painter, died of radium poisoning because her sister had gone to bed with her and had covered her in the dust.
Oh, my God.
I know. And in terms of the children, again, the scientists haven't really kind of come out to say anything about a link. The stuff I've read, the scientists seem to poo-poo the idea a little. But again, anecdotally... Mm-hmm. As I say, a lot of the children were born early or they were born small, and certainly some of the children, I know, you know, for example, Catherine Donahue's children, her son died when he was age 30 of a kind of cancer, and her daughter died young in her 50s, but also her daughter never really grew properly. She was always small. She was never really physically properly formed, and she herself wrote to the researchers and said, I've had so many problems all my life, and I think it's because of what happened to my mother. So certainly, you know, there are anecdotal connections, but I can't tell you with scientific accuracy, yes, it definitely, there was a definite connection. I can only tell you anecdotes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then what Albina, her baby was born, well, dead.
And that for me was so sad. You know, Albina's story is just so traumatic because she was trying for a baby for a long time, and all of her children, they didn't survive. They didn't make it. So
I think what's really sad about the story.
So, say that again.
I'm sorry, Kate. I'm sorry. I was just thinking out loud. I just said I'm so happy that you are sharing their story. I'm just so happy to see that it touched your heart enough, Kate, so that, you know, the story would not end there. It would continue. Thank you for that.
Yeah. And because these women had to fight.
They fought so hard, Catherine. I mean, you did such a, I mean, Catherine, Kate, you did such a great job of taking us back to find, listen, companies trying to cover up what they've done wrong is nothing new, because the companies that these girls work for, they, oh my gosh, they did everything they could, paid people off to say it's not us, it's them, it's something they've done, got people to lie, doctors, and then when they went to court, I mean, even the politicians, just they had, and then they're, like you said, these women are, they had this debilitating, painful condition, and they're still trying to fight the lies about them. One girl was even, they said, oh, well, no, she didn't die of the radium. We're pretty sure she had syphilis. So she's got to go to her grave.
Oh, my God.
Thinking she died of syphilis. You know, and they're still trying to get, they can't get doctors to help them. Go ahead.
It was a huge battle. I was going to say, when you were talking about the syphilis and the slurs, you know, the companies actually hired private investigators to dig up dirt on the women. I mean, that's how low down and dirty they were, you know. They threw one woman, husband, they tried to bring an insanity charge against him, because obviously, you know, his wife had essentially been murdered by the firm, and he was up in arms about it and trying to get stuff happening, and they tried to bring a charge of insanity against him and get him locked up. So it wasn't even just the women, it was their families as well, that these underhand activities, you know, extended to. It was really quite shocking. And as you say, the travesty really is that companies don't actually behave, you know, always much different today. We see evidence of cover-ups and so on, and I guess we've all just got to be vigilant and try and hold them to account.
It reminds me so much of lead paint. Like, you know, you hear over the years as time come out, all of the side effects from lead paint and the lead that's in water and stuff like that. It really does. The story just kind of reminds me of that part where the makers of, you know, the people who are selling these products, they know at some point that it's in there, but then before we find out about it, you know, they are able to get away with it for so long, and they're protected until we talk about it. That's the great thing about bringing things to light. You have to keep talking about it, and that's why
it's timely, because it could happen anytime.
Yes.
You don't know what's out there, and
right,
if corporations keep protecting themselves, this kind of behavior will go on and people die. So it's good to know, even after all of these years, that the lesson is not learned by these powerful people. And because it's a corporation, they say, oh, well, they must be the ones that are right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got the power
the
and the money.
Because
they've
got, they got the clout.
And you know what I think of it too? I can't help but think if it were men and not women, they might have had an easier time getting through. Maybe not completely, but I think if it were men and not women, and I also think if it were, and even though it was a good job to have and a somewhat glamorous job, still they were working women, not heiresses or something. They were women and working women.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite interesting to me that, you know, the only, the medical experts only started investigating when the first male employee of the Radium firm died. By that time, I think probably at least 7 women had died, I think, by that time. But it was only when a man died that finally someone properly started looking into it. I think that says it all.
I'm sorry, Jay. I was just going to say, it's just so weird to me that we see people glowing and it's not an alarm. It's something that you can justify it with, oh, don't worry, it'll wear off in a minute. That is not annoying.
I mean, one of the most haunting things is the girls would, because they'd been told it was safe and, you know, thought it was fabulous, the girls would actually paint it onto themselves. You know, they'd go in the dark room and paint moustaches and, you know, paint it on their teeth and make funny faces at each other. It was just a joke to them. But obviously they were doing it and it was killing them faster, you know. So that's a horrifying thought, to think of these kind of giggling girls just having a laugh, you know, larking about with the radium paint. You know, you can picture them in your mind doing it.
I had wondered about that, because they're young and they would have their silly moments, and they would, you know, say, oh, look at you, we're glowing. They could make makeup out of this, you know.
Yeah. That's what happened. But, I mean, in Ottawa, in Illinois, they were actually encouraged to take the paint home. So there was a story that one woman actually painted her bedroom walls with it. And they were encouraged to practice painting on their kind of their belt buckles and their, you know, dress buttons and their fingernails. So there was such a lax attitude about it. And it's, I mean, the astonishing thing is, you know, we've talked about how it was seen as a wonder substance there. What we haven't said is, from the moment it was discovered, people knew it was harmful. So large amounts were known to be massively damaging. Pierre Curie, who obviously, you know, discovered it with Murray, said that if he was left alone with a kilo of pure radium, it would burn all the skin off his body, blind him, and probably kill him as well. And so this is an incredibly toxic substance. You know, the book opens in 1901 with a scientist getting a radium burn because he's transporting radium in his waistcoat pocket. That's 1901. The dial painters didn't start work until just before, well, around the time of the First World War. So the radium studio opened in 1916. So you've got a distance of 15 years in which they know radium is dangerous, and you have people actually dying of radium poisoning. But because of all this research the radium firms were doing, which they were paying for because they wanted to build an industry around it, they thought that a small amount would be beneficial. So that's when suddenly this, you know, the cosmetics and the food and the toothpaste all started coming up because of this research that, you know, they wanted to find that it was positive. So, of course, they ignored anything to the contrary. But the fact was, you know, in the same company where the dial painters are putting their brushes in their mouth, in the lab just across, you know, literally kind of a couple of meters away from them, different building, you've got lab workers wearing lead aprons and wielding ivory-tipped tongs. The mind just boggles. There were safety precautions for the men working in the lab, but there were none for the women working in the studios.
Unbelievable. It's crazy.
They wanted to believe their own research, basically. When it became evident that there was a problem, they put profits before people, and they didn't shut it down. They covered it up.
Exactly. Happens over and over. Johnson & Johnson was just, I mean, this huge case now, and so many people coming out. Johnson & Johnson with the baby powder. We're talking about baby.
Talcum powder.
Yeah. Yeah, the talcum powder. Just think about
that. People my age, we all had talcum powder when we were
everybody.
Little.
But they knew about it long ago.
Yeah.
like you said, money over lives. Money over lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And the thing is that the radium still keeps on going. I mean, as you were saying, you know, it's got a half-life, I believe you said, of 1,600 years. So when the body dies, the radium still goes on. And keeps on bombarding the body.
It does, they will be glowing in their graves. And it was a problem for the towns as well. If you think of where the oil painting studios were, you know, those whole buildings were saturated with radioactivity. And what's shocking in Ottawa, after the Dahl painting firm stopped working there, they had various different companies that worked in the, you know, moved into the same building, including a meat company. And I was told anecdotally, a lot of people in Ottawa, there was one woman that said, I think all the brothers in one family got colon cancer within kind of 6 months of each other, and they'd all got their meat from the company that worked, that had set up shop in the radium studio. And there was massive cleanup operations that the EPA assisted with and found the funds to do. But I believe this cleanup is still going on. When I went in 2015, when I was researching the book, Peg Looney's niece drove me out to a place where they were still doing the cleanup because of the, you know, radiation that was there from the 1920s. It has a half-life of 1,600 years. It's still going strong.
After 100 years, almost.
But that, I mean,
here's the quote.
They can't eliminate it.
Yeah, Duffy, here's the quote I was looking for in The Radium Girls, where she says, Sarah Malifert says, Sarah's own life may have been cut short, but the radium inside her had a half-life of 1,600 years. It would be shooting out its rays from Sarah's bones for centuries, long after she was gone. Even though it had killed her, it kept on bombarding her body every day, every week, month after month, year after year. It is bombarding her body to this day.
Wow.
So it's going somewhere. It's out there somewhere. It's not. It's still alive. I mean, it's still active.
It's shocking.
Just amazing.
Sobering thought.
Now, Kate, you said you met some family members of some people and the attorney that helped them. So what was it like meeting them, and how did they feel about you writing the book?
They have just been so amazing. I could not be more thankful to them for their generous and informative response. Every family member that I contacted has been so warm. They've been so open. I think, you know, some of them must have, well, I know they were surprised when they got my random email, you know, from London, England, saying, tell us about your, you know, great aunt. but as you say, they were so gracious, and I had the pleasure, because I came to America for a month to research the book, so I was going all over, and so we had a chance to meet up, you know, to go for lunch, for dinner. I went to several retirement homes to meet sisters and nephews, and it was just wonderful, you know. For me, so special, because these women meant a lot to me, and to hear about them from the people that knew them best, you know, to hear what they liked cooking, or you know, what their personality was like, or, you know, that to hear stories of how Tom and Catherine, you know, would dance or whatever, was just wonderful to hear about, and really brought the women to life. And those family interviews have enriched the book beyond measure. You know, I couldn't have written what I have written without them, and they just had such, you know, it was so haunting sometimes, because they were haunted too by what had happened to their relatives. And for me, I think the most powerful moment in the interviews that I conducted was when I was speaking with Catherine Donahue's niece Mary, who is well into her 90s, and I went to her house to interview her. And she sat in her armchair, and I was sitting across from her, and I was interviewing her. And she often closed her eyes as she was talking, and you could see she was going back to when she was 13 years old, and she was going round to Catherine's house. She used to go round because she had a class nearby or something, so she used to pop in regularly. And she told me, because I think I said, "Jill, did Catherine, you know, did you ever hear Catherine cry out with the pain?" And she said, she just moaned. She didn't have the energy to scream. And to me, that was just... So you think, you know, you think if you hurt yourself, you might, you know, cry out, scream. You've got, you know, holes being bored into your bones. And so she, all she could do was moan. And Mary said she just remembered her moaning. That was the sound that she heard in Catherine's darkened house. She used to light the shades drawn, so she would be in the dark. She'd been moved downstairs by that point because she couldn't get up the stairs anymore. So she slept in her, she had her bed in the front room, and she'd lie there and she'd moan. And I just thought that was so haunting. And as I say, memories, you know, that's a memory that someone was, Mary was in that room with Catherine, and to be able to hear that from her and to try and tell readers about it through the book in bringing Catherine's story to life has just been amazing. And as I kind of said earlier, it's my honour to be telling this story. This is the Radium Girl story. This is not Kate Moore's book. This is the Radium Girl story, and I am just their representative helping them to shine.
Kate, I'm sure that they, and this is, well, meeting them, first of all, yes, anyone is grateful, I'm sure, and very touched and appreciative that their family member mattered to someone and that you're sharing it with someone else, and that you wanted to not only write about it, but you really wanted to get the essence of each person's personality. And that's what would matter a lot to family members and their friends, but also the fact that when I'm reading this, you brought them to life for me, you know, who liked to dance, who liked to sing, like you said, even the cutting up, making funny faces with the thing. Because that's what we do. You know, Kenya and I go out on trips, and we still do goofy things. We're not going to tell you what they are, but, you know, we still But, do we, Kenya? Yeah, you won't get it out of us, but, yeah, just little fun things, you know. Still, you brought me, you know, who had a dog, who had children, who liked this, who wanted to go, you know, who loved to sing. You know, each one of these people was a real living, breathing human being with feelings and with joys and with sorrows, and that loved family and had aspirations and had plans for the future and had hopes. You just brought it to all of us. And like I said, I'm sure that, you know, not only did it, talking to them help you really create these women and bring them to us, even though their lives were cut short, you know, you gave them back to their family members and to us, you know, for a while in the Radium Girls in your book. And I just love the way you unfolded the story, you shared it, and the struggle, and the people that did try to help. Not only were people not, you know, going, you know, trying to cause them more harm, but there were some people who were really trying to help, and you shared that, and I am just so grateful for this book, and I just wish you every bit of success.
Thank you so much. All the success in the world. Thank you for supporting the book and the women.
Oh, I'm proud to. Like I said, they've been hearing me talk about it at the beginning of every show. Also, David Hurley said again, he has another message for you. He says, great, in capital letters, great show. But now it's time he has to go read to his children and put them to bed. So he's got to go. But he said, thank you so much. He's really enjoyed it. And he's going to be interviewing you or reviewing it on. Yeah, thank you, Dave.
Thank you. Please review. And spread the word as well. If you've enjoyed listening to the story tonight, you know, do talk about it with your friends and family members. Let's get the story out there and get the girls remembered.
No, I'm sure we will. Now, how are we going to see? Now, your publisher is giving away one copy of The Radium Girls. So, how are we going to find who the winner is? I've got everybody's. I've got David's. Kenya and Duffy's names on pieces of paper. Should I have my dog draw one or what?
However you normally do it, it's cool. I'm sure. And I guess if you just let us know, we can do it off the air. The address to send it to, then my publisher can send it out. That's probably the easiest way.
Perfect.
Okay.
Madam Perry, if you're going to flip a coin, I say heads.
Well, I got three of you. Dungeons and Dragons coin?
Kate, I really enjoyed meeting you. Nice meeting you.
It's been a pleasure.
So, thank you for having me. So we have to go. So please look for The Radium Girls by Kate Moore. It's fresh out the bag. Listen, the lady's all over the place. She was on NPR last week and now with Madam Perry Salon, and I'm very humbled and honored by that. And don't forget, tomorrow night we have poet Rick McIntyre. It's an audio podcast, so we can't catch those gorgeous blue eyes of his on the podcast, but you can look at the picture while we're talking. Next week, radio dramatist and author Jay Smith. And the next night, Randy Ross with God Bless Cambodia, which is the memoir he wrote after he was laid off and took his money. You'll like this, I hope, Kate. After Randy was laid off of his corporate job a few years ago, he said he woke up, went to the bathroom, looked at the medicine cabinet and said, what does, he says, Vicodin, Clonopin, or Heineken, what does the unemployed person have for breakfast? So he said he took all three in an Ambien or something and went back to bed. But he decided to take all his money, his severance, and go on a trip to some Asian countries or all around. And so that became part of his book, along with, he said, because I couldn't keep on trying to do, trying to find a job and trying to get a date on Match.com was like an endless game of whack-a-mole, and most of the time he was the mole. But anyway, so Randy Ross, you're going to enjoy him. Thank you again for listening to Madam Perry Salon. Please sign up. Please buy the Radium Girls. And I love you, and I'll see you tomorrow night. And, Kenya, what do we always say to people at the end of the show?
I'm here. We love you. I hope you come back, Kate. We hope to see you back again. We really enjoyed
it. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Please come back. And everybody got to swing. Thank you, Kate.